WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rebecca Miller, wrote and directed the new movie, The Ballad of Jack and Rose. It's set in 1986 and stars her husband, Daniel Day-Lewis, as Jack, a father who lives with his 16-year-old daughter, Rose, on a beautiful island in an abandoned commune that he had co-founded in the 60s. He's managed to keep their lives isolated from what he sees as a corrupted world. But that world is moving in on them. A developer is building houses on the island. And Jack believes he will soon die of his heart ailment. Fearing he will leave his daughter alone, he invites his girlfriend and her two teenage sons to move in. All he tells Rose is that he's invited some guests, but she figures out what's happening.
They're not guests. They're moving in.
They're guests until we see. Let's just see how it works out.
They brought everything.
Everything of what?
They brought their lamps.
I've got to admit, those lamps were shocking. Well, it's just an experiment, Rosie. Let's just try it for a while and see how it works out. God forbid you might even end up wanting them to stay.
You tricked me!
It was a spur-of-the-moment decision.
She's so regular.
Kathleen, her name is, by the way. That's the whole point. She'll take care of things.
I took care of things.
We took care of things. Now I'm sick.
How long have you been lying to me? How could you not have told me?
I didn't think you'd understand.
That was Camila Bell as Rose, Daniel Day-Lewis as Jack. Rebecca Miller met Lewis at a screening of a film he was starring in, The Crucible, adapted from the play by her father, the late Arthur Miller. Rebecca Miller's first two films, Angela and Personal Velocity, won awards at the Sundance Film Festival. I talk with her about her new film. Now, the point of view of the father is that, you know, even though this utopian commune no longer exists, he's going to live here withdrawn from the rest of the world. He doesn't really like the rest of the world. He says to his daughter, "Decline and rot, my angel. That's the way of the world, except for you. You're exempt." So he wants them both to keep their distance from the world. And it seems in a way that you think his idealism has become both antisocial and kind of bullying.
Well, I think so. I think that Jack is a person who's always striving for his own goodness, trying to find his own goodness. He doesn't always succeed in that. And I think one of the things that makes him such a lovable character, finally, and why one can love him, is that that's what he's trying to do. Isolating Rose is something he did because he felt it was the moral thing to do. He felt like society had gone in a direction that he couldn't support. He feels like the world is a violent place, a materialistic place, and a place that where none of his values are reflected. And he wanted to raise Rose in a pure way. So he's doing what he thinks is the good thing to do. It's not that there are drawbacks, and I think he discovers those as the film rolls on.
What's the closest you've come to living in a commune?
I really haven't lived in a commune. I observed commune life as a child. My brother, who was 16 years older than me, really lived the life. He lived in one commune in California, then another one in Oregon. Near Ken Kesey. By that time, it was less of a commune and more of a loose, I think, kind of arrangement of people living near each other. But I was fascinated by the whole way of life of these people, the way that they seemed so free and so innocent, in a sense. And I think I was looking at it through the eyes of a child, which, of course, is a very specific perspective. And the idea of people being able to, I guess, subjugate their own egos to the idea of the whole was something that seemed like such an impossible and beautiful dream to me. And I think that's where, you know, why I gave Jack that ideal.
Do you think that the people who your brother lived with and your brother himself succeeded in subjugating their egos to the larger group?
No, finally, they all went off to live private lives. And I think one of the things the film is about is how hard it is to be utopian and how, in a way, that utopianism, perfectionism in general, is a kind of a dangerous thing. Jack has become a very unforgiving person because of it, which, you know, and finally, I guess I'm plugging for just a more forgiving way of looking at people in life, but without losing one's idealism.
Now, I understand that a much earlier draft of The Ballad of Jack and Rose was written more from the point of view of Rose, the daughter, whereas the final movie, you're really seeing both of their points of view, I think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what happened was I started writing this in 1993, at which point I was a daughter. And by the time I finished it, I was a mother. And I think that part of the shift in the screenplay had to do with me understanding more and more Jack's point of view and becoming more and more fascinated by that character and realizing that the balance of the screenplay needed to be, we needed more of Jack. And in fact, when I cut the film, after I'd shot the film, started to cut it and saw the power of Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, I realized that again, I found myself so drawn to his conflict that it just needed to be more central, even though in the end it is both of their film. I think that one is very drawn into his conflict, because conflict, finally, that's drama, you know.
Which conflict are you describing?
His conflict, I suppose, between his intense love for his daughter, which in fact finally is just too much to bear. He needs to bring other people into their world so that he really doesn't fall in love with her. And that conflict in him and that generates the action in the screenplay.
What made you think about how parental love can risk crossing the line to an almost romantic love?
I think that the love of a parent for a child is oceanic, endless, and kind of bottomless. And that the love of a mother for, this is my experience, of course, is only as a mother, but for her baby is really, it's a love that has all loves inside of it. It feels like being in love. It feels like, you know, protective love. It feels like every kind of love. And of course, we all live in a society where we know our roles and we act within our roles, and that makes civilized life possible. But when you put two people in a world where there's no one else and there's no society and there's no civilization and one of them is completely unsocialized, it makes for an interesting story.
Now, you cast your husband, Daniel Day-Lewis, as Jack, the father. It would have been potentially awkward had he said to you, "I don't really like this very much. I'm not going to do the role."
I mean,
what kind of choice does it give him?
No, but the thing is that you have to, in order to understand that, you have to understand that Daniel just can't do anything as a favor. I mean, he's really incapable of do his work as a favor, because he just wouldn't be able to. So it gives you a lot of freedom in offering him something, knowing that even if you are his mother or his sister, his wife, he really won't say yes, because he wouldn't feel like he could do the best work unless he has that kind of gnawing curiosity that finally makes him say yes to something. Generally, in my experience, he's looking to say no because he knows he has to give himself over so completely, and it's a long time, and there are a lot of other things he'd like to be doing.
My guest is Rebecca Miller. She wrote and directed the new film, The Ballad of Jack and Rose. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rebecca Miller. She wrote and directed the new film, The Ballad of Jack and Rose. Her father was the playwright Arthur Miller. Your father was Jewish, and that figured into some of his work. I read that you converted to Catholicism at the age of 13. Why did you convert?
I had neighbors who were Catholic, and somehow I ended up getting a ride to church every Sunday. And they were my best, it was actually the family of my best friend growing up, who Rodney is based on, the character of Rodney in my film is based on Chris. And I was very taken by the power of, I guess, what Catholicism is all about. I mean, what I perceived it to be all about. Unfortunately, I mean, I think I took the worst of it. I was very interested in guilt and hell, my two main things that I was interested in, and only later came to appreciate the more positive elements of Christianity, like love and mercy. I was had my own little mythology as a child. I was quite haunted by spiritual matters from a very early age. And I think that because I wasn't, my parents weren't religious in the sense of going to synagogue or church, I had a kind of hunger for some, I guess, some way of embodying this spiritual hunger I had. And church was it. That was, I got the ride to Catholic church, and so I became Catholic. You know, it gave me a lot and it taught me a lot those years.
Let me read something from your collection of short stories, Personal Velocity, upon which your film is based. And this is from the short story Greta. Strangely, Greta had never felt particularly Jewish. Her parents hadn't ever brought her to a synagogue. Being Jewish was taken for granted in the family, like having skin. When Greta thought about being Jewish, she thought of a dark room with an old lady in a rocking chair in the corner. She didn't know why. Does that describe you too?
Well, not exactly. Greta's is far more, her family's much more Jewish than mine was. Her mother was born in a camp. My mother was a Christian Austrian. I mean, she wasn't actually actively a Christian, but she had been born, she had been baptized Protestant in Austria. So I think that some of Greta's feelings about Jewishness have to do with the kind of taste of death that she has from her mother's experience. And a feeling like there's a kind of pall cast over the Jewishness in her. I mean, for me, I guess I didn't identify with being Jewish at all early on. And I'm not sure exactly why. I think perhaps because we didn't go to synagogue and because my friends were Christians. And I was living in a small town in Connecticut. There just weren't any, there were no Jews around. And so I just identified with the people that were around me. And since there was nothing counterbalancing that at home, really, that's the way I went. I mean, I'd say that my father was culturally quite Jewish. I mean, I felt I could, I knew the difference between the Jewish humor in my family and his side of the family and the more Christian kind of way of looking at things that I sort of understood. But the rituals and the history and all of that was not really part of my life.
Are you still a practicing Catholic?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm just a confused person.
Can I ask you how you drifted away from the church?
I think I finally couldn't reconcile the way I needed to live my life and the curiosity I had about life with really being a good Christian, a good Catholic, in the sense of, well, in particular sexuality when I was just starting out as a young woman. And also, maybe the most important thing was that I finally learned more about other religions, Judaism and Islam and the rest of it. And I thought, well, why are they, how can they be wrong? Why are they necessarily wrong? And then Christianity is right. And my idea, I just ceased to believe that there could be an answer. I believed in God, and I think I still find myself believing in God. But I think I've ceased to believe that that anybody has has broken the code. I guess I believe in the mystery.
Can I ask how your father felt when you became Catholic? If he accepted that as a...
He wasn't happy.
He was
yeah.
not happy.
I wouldn't expect he'd be happy. No. Maybe that's why I did it. I don't know.
What, part of a little rebellion?
Maybe. I don't know. I didn't feel that way at the time, but, you know.
No, I read that one of your next projects is going to be adapting your father's first play into...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to direct it. I'm just writing it.
Oh.
I'm just adapting it to write.
Why did you decide to do that?
I was offered it a while ago, and it was a way of spending more time with my dad. And at that time, I knew he was sick, and I always liked the play a lot, The Man Who Had All the Luck, and I thought I could give it a go.
So this was a play that opened in 1944 and closed after four performances. Did you talk to him while he was still alive about this play and get any insights that you could use for the adaptation?
Yeah, but sadly, not enough. You know, I wish that I had started earlier.
Your mother was a photographer. Did she influence you visually? Did she help teach you to think visually?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, that I would say that my influence is almost more from my mother than my father. My mother was... talked about photographs and paintings, took me to galleries, talked to me about composition, about the power of composition, about how if you photograph something one way, it means something different than if you move 2 feet to the left or the right. And I think that also my mother's sweetness and her tenderness toward her subjects was something that I guess influenced the way I like to be on the set, you know, a kind of non-aggressive approach, which was definitely hers.
I want to get back to your new movie, The Ballad of Jack and Rose. One of my favorite characters in your film is one of the sons, Rodney, one of the sons of the father's girlfriend.
Right.
And so, you know, this woman and her two sons, two teenage sons, move in with Jack and Rose. You know, there's two sons here. One of them is kind of sullen and rebellious and... like wild and unpredictable, but in a quiet, sullen way.
Yeah.
And the other son he's very funny. He's very observant. His goal is to be a hairdresser. He loves hair.
Right.
And he's overweight, and his mother's always riding him on that, always trying to get him to eat less. But he's like the voice of reason within the movie, and a funny voice of reason at that. And I'd be interested in hearing about this character.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that character was sort of loosely based on my best friend growing up, a boy who he and I were kind of inseparable for many, many years up till high school. And through high school, actually. And he was just a very funny, chubby, extremely intelligent kid for me, Rodney is somebody who turns his pain into humor and sees life in a humorous way. And he's a very, very touching character. And I think that, you know, the love I have for this prototype is, you know, you can feel it. And also, I have to say that Ryan McDonald, who's the young actor who played Rodney, just took that part and really made it into a real person. You know, it's one thing to write all those lines on the page, but I had to listen to many auditions in which, you know, lovely young men just couldn't get it because it's really, really hard to do that, to be funny like that in a natural way and to be so touching. And I think Ryan is going to be a very, very important actor in his life. I really believe in him.
Are you still in touch with your old friend who Ryan is based on?
Oh, yeah. He lives in the town where I grew up still, and we see each other all the time.
Rebecca Miller, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Rebecca Miller wrote and directed the new film, The Ballad of Jack and Rose.